Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we're live. Welcome along to the Huddle Breakdown. Enda here. James is with me as well, as is Alan. We're only 3 minutes late for the YouTube live stream, so we're getting closer to that ever, you know, that we can't just quite reach that final hurdle of getting here right on time, but we're here nonetheless. James, Alan, how are we doing?
Hanging in there. Nice to see you guys.
Yeah. Hi, everyone.
The good news is that football is returning the way it should be, with fans in the stadiums next week. Celtic taking on Hibs on Monday night. So Monday night football will be a Celtic special. But today we don't have any football to talk about. So what we said we were going to do last week on the show was we were going to look in more depth at the Celtic defence this season. So on broadly speaking, Celtic's defence has actually been quite solid this year. They're the best defence in the Scottish League so far in the season. You wouldn't know that with some of the media coverage that Celtic get in terms of their defending, but they are the best defence in the league so far. So I guess we'll do an overall squad look at... Jeez, that was a terrible way to say it. We'll do an overall squad summary of the different players: Carr Starfelt, Cameron Carter-Vickers, Stephen Welsh, who is in the papers for transfer rumours this week as well. And then we'll make a decision on whether or not Celtic have had a good defence or not this year. Alan, do you want to kick us off with some stats on the individual players, or where do you want to take us on this one?
Yeah, so when I look at centre-backs, and centre-backs are the players that tend to have their actions on the field tend to be dominated more so than by defensive actions than any other player, perhaps defensive midfielders who are very sort of, you know, limited in that role, we might argue as well. But generally speaking, whereas fullbacks for Celtic, there's a lot of noise in the data, because when you start looking at things like challenges and duels, there's as many challenges and duels almost in the offensive third as is in the defensive third. But for centre backs, if you look at defensive actions, it's actually I find it quite useful. I know the general feeling is within people that do analytics, and certainly people who are far more skilled than I, is that, you know, defending is quite difficult to measure because it is a collective activity. But nevertheless, we can capture individual actions. And what I've found through a couple of aggregated metrics is that by using those, they do tend to actually match, you know, the good old eye test of if you had to plot your players or rank them without any data, and then you actually had some data, the two lists would actually be pretty close in that sense. Now that might just be luck, of course. it may not be very scientifically sound, but obviously the longer you do this, the more years of data. And I've got these sort of defensive action metrics going back now to the 14-15 season, so it's quite a lot of data, really, quite a lot of different defenders in there to compare. And there's a couple which I've talked about in the past, but, you know, again, for people that are newer or don't remember, what have you, bit of a mouthful, but I'll try and break it down. Defensive action success rate is quite a mouthful to start with, but it is really what it says. It's a percentage of defensive actions only that result in the player actually winning the ball, in the sense that they won the duel. The winning the ball piece is about maintaining possession. I'll come to that in a minute. But the defensive action piece is, if to bring it to life a little bit, if you think of it in terms of duels. So duels really split two ways. One aerially, so headed duels where you're jumping for the ball and challenging for the ball in the air. And second would be ground duels, tackles, challenges on the ground. But then you also add in things like interceptions, blocking crosses, blocking shots, shielding the ball out. So lots of things like that. So it really covers those types of actions. It excludes things like passing and all the other offensive actions that players get involved in. So it's very specific. The other piece is around when you actually go into a challenge or any sort of defensive action, do you actually win the ball in terms of, does possession end up being for Celtic, which is a really key thing for defenders. So these two things are related, but they're slightly different. One is just about, I could win 10 headers, but each time I win the header, it could go out for a throw-in to the other team, right? Whereas possessions one would be, I've won 10 tackles, and every time I've actually, not only have I won the tackle, I've actually got the ball at the end of it, or the ball's gone to a Celtic player. So slightly different things, but related. Anyway, so if you plot those two things, I've found that if you look at the sort of top right hand of those results, the players that are in there are the likes of Van Dijk, Ayer, Chris Julien would be in there. Benkovic, who's been quite topical this week. And then if you look at the bottom left, would be players that are scoring lower percentages. You're looking at your Effie Ambrose, your Jack Hendrys, right? So as I say, and in the middle would be, your sort of middle class, if you like, of defenders, would be your Simunovic's and your Boyatas and your Sviatchenko's and people like that. So it works out pretty well. So long preamble. In terms of the current group of central defenders, where do they fit? Well, the good news, let's start with the good news, is that Carter Vickers is firmly in the top right-hand corner. A very dominant defensive player. He scores highest of all central defenders in his ability to win possession back through defensive actions, as you can see on the chart. And he's up there with Julien and Benkovic in terms of his defensive action success in that sort of Van Dijk kind of territory. And this was a young Van Dijk, remember, as well. Ayer would have been a little bit higher in normal times. He suffered from his last season being that last season, which was poor for a lot of players. But anyway, Carter Vickers, the good news story there is firmly in that top right-hand corner. Then we come to Stephen Welsh, who is kind of hovering just below the middle class, as let's call it. But I would suggest that he's 21. I think his birthday's next week. Happy birthday, Stephen. He's looked like he's already, as a young player, establishing himself as a pretty solid defender. And in that basis, I think is somebody that's probably worth having in the squad. And then the sort of less good news is in the bottom right hand corner. Is Starfelt, who is really actually the least successful defender in defence actions of all the central defenders that have racked up sufficient minutes to be included in this chart, and is only better than Hendry in terms of winning the ball back from his defensive actions. So this is a pretty sorry tale, as I outlined last week with some examples from the League Cup final. So that I found this chart, and I know it's boiled down, it's only defensive actions, it's quite simple in that sense, but it's a bit reductive a little bit, but I do feel confident that it tells quite an accurate story when you see the plotting of the players that we're all quite familiar with.
So I think the first question that I would ask about this is the likes of Cameron Carter-Vickers, who's right up at the top. He's playing in a Celtic side that have been dominating possession quite a bit this year and playing on the front foot, whereas last year Celtic were a complete mess. And we talked about it until the cows went home, about Scott Brown and the lack of control in midfield and the lack of legs. If you were to take Cameron Carter-Vickers from what you're seeing with him now, and stuck him into a Celtic team of last year where you don't have that control, how would that translate, do you think?
So listen, this is not an easy question to answer. So it's a good question, but what I would say is, and I know where you're kind of going, I think I know where you're going with this, but what I would say is, if you look at Carter Vickers and Starfelt, if you imagine that Starfelt has performed that poorly with such a good centre back beside him, that is absolutely damning. And similarly, for Carter Vickers to perform so well with such a poor player beside him, it is incredible, actually. Because if you look at these charts, and what I found is, because I always build this, I take a view of this at least twice a season, is that Ayer and Julian are together, Van Dijk and Denier were together, and that made sense, right? Because it's defense is a system, it has to have all the component parts working for the full defense to be working. So what I'd say is, for Celtic to be performing as well as they have been relatively in terms of lowest expected goals against in the league, lowest actual goals against in the league, and for Carter Vickers to be clearly the best central defender in the league by a mile, that is simultaneously of massive credit to him, but incredibly damning of Starfelt, I would suggest.
James, do you want to get in on this?
Yeah, I'll try to add a little bit of context from a 30,000 feet. So StatsBomb tracks their XG metric through various phases of play, one of which is just open play, you know, set pieces, open play. You can do it by, you know, direct free kicks, indirect free kicks. You can slice and dice corners, you know, you can slice and dice a lot of different ways. So if you just look at it from open play, Celtic are basically in line with the 1920 season. I think it's 0.31 versus 0.32, the former being 1920. So again, we're talking about Celtic domestically concede very little from open play. Last season in the debacle that we all kind of lived through, that went all the way up to 0.52. So again, relative to the rest of the league, still microscopic, very little. But I mean, that's a huge percentage difference. And when you think about this, as we talk about it from a probability perspective, that's effectively two decent chances more a game that you're conceding. If you think about it as like 0.10 twice was the difference. And so that was the fine margin between calamity last season and being effectively a lockdown defending team in 1920 and in this season. And to what you guys were just discussing, I think, you know, the idea, I think a delta on that in the relative organization, let's call it, you know, as I say, the Jenga tower, so to speak, of Ange Ball versus kind of the chaos that we had with the team last season, and particularly in midfield. Imagine taking Starfelt out of this structured kind of controlled environment and plopping him down in a Shane Duffy role last season. And think about what the delta would be on his error rate, potentially, having a midfield and not having inverted fullbacks to shield defensive transitions with Scott Brown in the final third trying to press and chase the ball. I mean, that would be just intuitively potential calamity. So I think on a relative basis, Carter Vickers probably looks better because, as any defender would, in a system that's shielding them more structurally. And whereas you put any defender in that mess last season, and they're going to end up having a more difficult time, just because anyone who's, you know, by definition, forwards tend to be a little bit pacier than center backs. And if you end up with more transitions, one-on-one type of situations, you're going to have center backs make mistakes or get beat one-on-one, that kind of thing. So I think it's a very insightful question, Enda, because it is, I think, that structural system, that context as far as what they're playing in is very important. As we've talked about endlessly with Duffy and, you know, the role that he was asked to play and the lack of protection that he was kind of victimized with from midfield last season.
Mm. There's a podcast on the Ringer network that people might be familiar with, the Rewatchables, and there's a category on it where they do unanswerable questions. And I feel like I should probably add that into this podcast, because I generally ask unanswerable questions of you, but I'm going to ask one now, and it's regarding the actual system of the back four that Celtic play. Does Starfelt look worse because there hasn't been a proper left back beside him? Or are we thinking that this is down to Starfelt being fundamentally flawed as a player?
Well, again, there always has to be most. If you deconstruct virtually any goal that Celtic or any team concede, there's usually a number of small things that have gone wrong. But what I do track is individual errors. You need video analysis and a lot of time to do proper systemic defensive structure analysis and say, well, you should have been 2 yards further to the left, and you should have been tucked in a bit here, and you should have been, your body shape should have been this shape, not that shape, relative to the strike. Oh, you, that's the level of detail you'd want to get into if you were doing a proper job on this, and I don't have the time to do that, much as I'd love to. But I do track individual errors, and Starfelt, again, by those metrics, is up in, well, he's in sort of Ambrose, Yaya Touré, more error prone than Bitton, which is not good. Whereas again, Carter Vickers is the least number of defensive errors of any of the central defenders that I've measured. So what does that tell you? It tells you probably, it speaks to things like concentration. It speaks to things like positional play. So just instinctively or just being in the inherently generally being in the right place more often than not. As I've mentioned before with Starfelt, I think he's got some inherent physical limitations. Not only is he not very tall, and therefore aerially, he loses a lot of headers. His positioning is not good. He's usually too far forward, and he's usually too aggressive relative to trying to win the ball. He's trying to win balls he shouldn't. I mean, Duffy was terrible for that as well, trying to win headers that he had no chance. You just sometimes have to make contact with the striker, make it difficult for the striker to get a clean connection, and then everyone else kind of feed off the second ball, or at least be in good body shape to then react to the next action. Just accept you're not going to win the ball. Just think basic, you know, really basic stuff like that. And as I've said to you before, I felt sorry for him in the first game of the season when he stumbled and fell against Hearts. But actually, what I've seen so far is that his coordination, I think, is lacking. His actual neural network, I don't think, works as effectively. And I've said this before. If you just watch him play, if you watch him in a scenario where he receives the ball and then he has to turn back and then pass it back to the goalkeeper, he nearly falls over when he's doing that. His body movement just isn't right. There's just something wrong about it. And it's over-exaggerated and it's uneconomical and it's not efficient. And when you're in a split-second situation like, you know, chasing Nesbitt back in the cup final, and your body coordination is all over the place, even someone like Kevin Nesbitt can beat you, in a ground race. So I just think he's got some fundamental things which I just don't. Whether you had Greg Taylor beside him, or whether you had Bolland Goling beside him, or whether you had Roberto Carlos beside him, you'd still get those issues. Would be my view. I haven't done any analysis that says Starfelt with so and so beside him, well, he was pretty solid in that game, but when you put him beside him, and he wasn't, because I think the more important relationship is Starfelt and Carter Vickers. Yeah, and Carter Vickers, you couldn't query, is a very solid defender.
Yeah. The first couple of weeks, I remember with Starfelt, we were sort of cutting him a little bit of slack with the misplaced passes and the awkwardness of it. And we put it down to a lack of football, but it turns out that actually just seems to be Starfelt as a player. One of the key things that you're looking for a Celtic defender is somebody who can actually play the ball out from the back and be comfortable with it and be able to do that. We might touch on the actual ball progression in just a sec, but before we move off the actual defending aspect of it, you might run us through the defensive errors, because Duffy was a key target of people online giving him abuse for the errors and the obvious errors that he made last year as a defender. But in terms of Starfelt and Carter Vickers in this year's defence, what is the error rate like?
Yep. So, I mean, Duffy was around over 1.2 sort of individual defensive errors per 90 minutes, which is the highest I've ever recorded. I think Duffy and Ambrose were similar in the sense that I think their errors, a lot of them came from a good place, if I can put it that way. It came from trying to do a good thing, if not the right thing, trying to be a helpful citizen and teammate, but actually usually overreaching. And ultimately, it's a bad decision, right? So whether it's coming from a good intentions, I'm sure most actions on the football pitch are good intentions from a player. They were just ill thought out and ill executed. And I think with Ambrose, there was obviously issues of concentration and positioning. With Yaya Touré's up there, it was just age regression. It was simple as that. This guy had been a top player, and he just had reached 35 and age regressed. And it happens to everybody, sadly. With Bitton, it's reaction time. He doesn't react quick enough to danger. To see when he doesn't see it quick enough and therefore move and his body respond quick enough and to actually prevent things from happening, and things tend to happen on his watch. And with Starfelt, I think it's more a mixture of, as I say, this physical awkwardness, a lack of physique and physicality as a defender in the Scottish League specifically. Now, Carter Vickers isn't much taller than him, but he compensates by being a much more kind of robust player, but also just by making better decisions about how to position himself physically, that sort of physical intelligence, I would call it. And I think with Starfelt, the other piece that I touched on in terms of what drives that error rate is that I think he, aware that he's not the most physical or tallest defender, I think he overcompensates by trying to win balls that he simply can't, and therefore positionally he's sometimes suspect. So that would be my take on it.
James, your thoughts on the error rate and whether or not that's something that we can work on to improve?
Yeah, I'm, if I was going to be charitable and positive, I'd say the sample size still isn't huge. So there could be some just sequencing issues there from a pure stats dork perspective. I'm not terribly optimistic that that's the reality of the situation. I mean, I'd throw out that caveat, but again, I think Alan offers all of these great insights relative to qualitative observation and experience and knowledge that I don't have. What I can do is analyze the data and offer my inferior views in the same regard. So I'm going to refrain from the latter because it's, not worth anything. So statistically, and the more advanced metrics, I mean, it's evident across the ensemble of the things that I look at that he's a fish out of water. He's not suited for this role. At least that's my analytical conclusion. That might be biased to a degree because I didn't think he was to begin with when I evaluated his track record in Russia and even preceding that. So I don't think he's ever going to fit with the way that we're playing. Alan's talked about in the past where Ange has made some tweaks to try and maybe help with that, to dilute the impact of some of his, poor fit with some of the aspects of what we're playing. But as I talked about last week, I don't see us regressing away from the issues that are going to amplify his issues. I see us getting more advanced in implementing Ange's style of play. And if you have more transitions, you have more, advancement as far as the defensive line to try and squeeze the game forward and to keep that pressure going with the counter pressing. And, the more you move up, the more space, and we've talked about this before relative to Hart not being as advanced in that sweeper keeper role, you're going to have more opportunities potentially for the issues that Starfelt has. I would actually be concerned that you could get a higher degree of error rates, particularly as we start to play teams that have a little bit more pace to confront him. When we go back to against Hearts again here coming up, or we play Rangers several times more this season, Those are the kind of matchups that I really get concerned about. I actually worry that it's going to get worse rather than better.
Okay. He does make the team a lot better looking, though. I think we can all agree on that. He's a very, very handsome man.
He's a handsome man, but I think Welsh is a handsome guy, too. How dare you? That's...
Yeah. Welsh has got a big Scottish head on him, though, compared to Karl Starfelt. Doesn't have us Ulster Scots don't have the same bone structure as they do in Scandinavia, so we can't compete. Let's talk about actual football instead of digressing onto that. One of the key players that Celtic lost this year, Christopher Eyer, I think if you look at him as a player, if you ask me to recall one thing that he did very well, that was bringing the ball out of the defence. He was, that was his move. He was able to run even often as times up as far as the opposition box without getting tackled. He was able to retain possession and move the team forward. So in terms of the defence this year, Alan, who are you looking at in terms of ball progression? What are they ranking up in that sense?
Yep. So again, Carter Vickers here seems to actually excel. Now, when you're talking about ball progression, especially around breaking lines, the pack passing that I talk about, we are as much talking about style of play as we are an individual. So you've got to think about the two things together. How are the players being asked to play? And then how are they implementing that style? So if you think about, for example, a good example to back this up would be Boyata, right? So when Boyata broke into the team under Rodgers, I think it was something like five or six matches he went through and he didn't actually give away a single pass. So like it was zero passes given away. It was something like five or six. Or I might be exaggerating, but it was something like that. It was, if you didn't know football and just looked at stats, you'd think, oh, he's the best passer in the world because he never gives the ball away, right? But of course, we all knew that Dedrick Boyata was possibly the worst passer in the whole team. But Rodgers had said to him, your job is to get the ball and pass it no more than 10 yards to the nearest hoop shirt. That's all I want you to do. I don't want you to be looking forward. I don't want you to be pinging balls into the corners. Just give it to someone else, right, as quickly as you can. And if you're going to play like that, yeah, you're going to rack up a lot of good passing stats in terms of, passes complete. You're not going to bother the scorers as far as pack passing and secondary assists and chance creation and all that sort of stuff. So you've got to think about it in terms of what are you being asked to do, what's your role in the team, what is the team's style of play, and then what is your ability to execute that. So we know that generally packing under Postecoglou is up, right? So it could, because he's wanting to get the ball forward quickly, but he wants to also keep possession. So Lennon last season went more towards getting the ball quicker. And he wasn't so bothered about keeping possession. So it was that, and that all added to the lack of control that we saw relative to this season. So Postecoglou's teams have got high levels of control and high levels of penetration when it works. When it doesn't work, you see what happened against St Mirren, and you see what happened against Livingston, where the penetration's low, but the control is high in that sense. So bearing all these things in mind, if you, I don't know if you've got a chart on this you're able to ping up, but you'll see that actually this season's three centre-backs, Carter Vickers, Starfelt and Welsh, are all at the top of the chart as far as number of pack passes per 90 minutes compared to what is a very small sample of players, because packing something that I've only done in the last few seasons. I don't go back to 14-15 for that. In fact, I think it's 19-20 that I've got on this. It's only the last couple of seasons, really. So very small sample, but also... in terms of players, but also what you're seeing there is a reflection of the style of play as much as the ability of the players. But the fact that Carter Vickers' numbers are very high in this regard is encouraging compared to the other two. The other piece that this chart isn't showing you is, what do these pack passes actually achieve in terms of how many players did those pack passes actually take out the game. Now, I've not shown this on the chart, but what I can tell you is that if I said to you that Carter Vickers' packing score was 60, and that's probably a bit of an abstract number to most people, but then Starfelt's was 45, you'll see there's a reasonably big gap there. Carter Vickers is not only breaking the lines more often than the other two, he's also taking out more players. So it's riskier passing done more often. So that in an Ange ball scenario, that's a really good outcome. Okay, and that, what you'll also see on that chart is all, the other dimension is progressing the ball through carrying the ball, so running with the ball essentially. And what you'll see on there is that Ayer is just a complete outlier. Now, James will be able to chip in here because he looks at benchmarking against Europe, you know, players across Europe. But I would hazard a guess that Ayer is probably elite at European, if not world level, at carrying the ball at his feet. And therefore, that outlier, even for Celtic, would probably be reflected, whichever team he played for.
Yeah, at Celtic, I mean, I don't have it directly in front of me, but I remember doing it in the past, you know, in Y Scouts database for progressive runs, which is, you know, again, it's not the exact same as Allen's metrics, but it's going to correlate pretty well. You know, I benchmarked Frimpong, for example, and his playing at Celtic with the space that we enjoy. He was, I think, top two in the world out of, like, I don't know, 20,000 fullbacks. Frimpong was, you know, in the top couple, and Ayer was similarly like in top five in center backs out of, you know, thousands and thousands globally. Now, again, some of that has to do with the circumstances of Celtic relative to the league and how much possession we have, and, you know, how much other teams sit back and don't try to press our fullbacks and center backs when they do have the ball, that kind of thing. But it does suggest, you know, there are other teams that play in similar circumstances and they don't have guys posting the kind of carrying stats that Ayer has. And I suspect that's probably what, you know, clubs like Leverkusen and Brentford were looking at when they were, you know, seeing them as appealing candidates, because they do really add. I mean, it does change a dimension when a player can break lines that way, even and progress the ball that rapidly and with control. You know, you don't really, the risk factor being relatively low of that kind of progression. So yeah, he's been a true outlier in that sense, not only at Celtic but globally.
Yeah, and we haven't really, and we're not asking the current centre backs to do that. Really, is what the data shows. So no one's replaced that as such. But then I think with the fullbacks inverting to create overloads in midfield, that almost wouldn't make any sense to then have the centre back running past you. It's kind of a useful thing to have always, because it just adds another dimension to the attack. But it's not a role that either of the current cadre are being asked to do or seem to have a great aptitude for.
Yeah. Before we finish up on the defense, there's a lot of conversation going on in the comments right now about height and the importance or lack of importance when it comes to height in our defense. So, like, I'm guessing from this, from just what I see on TV, and often that can be quite misleading. Like, is Carter Vickers just about 6 foot? Then again, Starfelt, maybe just about the same. Stephen Welsh. We've had a long-term discussion of whether Stephen Welsh is that 6 foot or not. And then the fullbacks with Juranovic and Ralston and Greg Taylor. Scales is about the only guy as our fullbacks that has any sort of height whatsoever. So are we saying it's important? Or are we saying it's not important? James, I know that you definitely feel we need more height in general throughout the team, but...
It's not necessarily height. It doesn't have to be height. Height obviously correlates with aerial proficiency. I mean, it can be vertical leap. I think something that Carter Vickers has is broadness. So he's a big dude from shoulder to shoulder kind of thing.
Tough guy to battle with in the air, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. So as Allen said earlier about Starfelt not doing a lot of these things, it looks like Carter Vickers is a lot more adept at some of the dark arts of positioning and, you know, staying close to attacking players. So, you know, I always think about it from a systems perspective. And when you've got a bunch of players that aren't tall, many of them that aren't built like Carter Vickers, meaning a shit brick house, you know, you can do as much as you can from a system perspective organizationally. And I think we've done that, meaning that if you look at, you know, what we're conceding on set pieces now from an XG perspective, it's actually quite good. but we're still conceding more than we should relative to XG. And I think some of that has to do with the nexus of our guys maybe not being as proficient size-wise and aerially, and then, you know, mix that in with Hart's relative lesser mobility coming for crosses. And that's been a source of vulnerability for us. But again, Celtic are not Man City, right? So the idea that we're going to engineer with endless amounts of money an optimized squad that has no issues or vulnerabilities is unrealistic. So, you know, relative to how our manager wants to play, you know, and the players available and our wage bill and the players that we can attract, you know, is it less than ideal? Yes. But if you're going to concede opportunities, aerial ones are usually the least likely to be a problem, statistically speaking. So far, we're going to pick a battle as far as where we're going to be weak. That is probably the one area that I would say, okay, I can live with that relative to, you know, other issues as far as chances being created. I actually think our defending of non-aerial crosses is probably as big of an issue and concern as opposed to, let's say, corners or set pieces. Because we, like I said, we've done really well. You can tell it's reflected in the data that organizationally we've been doing a better job this season, as far as, you know, being organized and having our act together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, height doesn't necessarily mean good. You know, you need to be able to use that height efficiently and well, because I mean, Christopher Dier was tall, but he was not necessarily good at defending set pieces, so.
You're sounding like me with my wife. Sizes and everything.
Well, I'm one of those people who, you know, I cling to that 6 foot. I'm like 5'11" and 3/4", but I'm 6 foot.
That's the same as me. Yeah. It's just not quite ever made that 6 foot.
Round up.
No, yeah. No, listen, for me, you know, for me, it's not, if I was to rank the key attributes of defender, you know, positioning, anticipation, you know, concentration, speed, and what Vickers has, which is the ability to he's not a particularly big guy, but he's strong, which means he can jump with you and mess you up, even if he's not taller than you, as in force you into the wrong position, knock you off balance, and so the header's a mess, etc. So these are all those attributes. I would put all those things as possibly more important than just raw height in essence, but you know, you are going to be challenged in this way in Scotland. We can't get away from that. Every single team in the league averages 75 plus long balls a game. You're going to get challenged in that way, but I think this has been an interesting case study because we do have three defenders that are all around about the 6'1" at most mark, and they're all very different actually in how they how they compete with their in aerial challenges. So it just goes to show you that actually height isn't the key factor.
Well, and that's what's so interesting about the Starfelt case study is that, you know, again, if you think about kind of pluses and negatives. So Iyer wasn't very good in attacking headers. In fact, he was pathetic in his track record. And even defending in aerially in corners, for example, he was kind of mixed. Where he was really good was when the play was in front of him. And, you know, teams are lumping the ball up into our half. And, you know, we had to control those headers and win, you know, as Alan says, maintain possession or win possession as opposed to just heading it out of play. Iyer was actually at least functional or decent at that. Starfelt, but before I move on from Iyer, what Iyer had was recovery pace, right? So when you're playing that high line, you know, okay, well, you have the pluses and minuses and what he's good at. Mentioned what he wasn't necessarily all that good at. He was good at defending aerially in a certain circumstances, and he had recovery pace. So if there was a breakdown in play, he could get his ass back and you know, still defend. Starfelt doesn't have any of that. Like he's not good aerially, period, for the most part. He doesn't have this recovery pace, which again, when you're playing that high line, so, you know, CCV has other things. He doesn't have that recovery pace either, but positionally he seems to be very good, intelligent player spatially, And he has a lot of that defending in the box, one-on-one, that physicality that Alan mentioned. So, you know, if you kind of line up all these things, what I'll be curious to see and interested to see with Julian is really good inside the box aerially, attacking aerially, also defending aerially in our, you know, kind of defensive half out in space, but he doesn't have that recovery speed. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how that shakes out relative to playing in Ange's system. Hopefully he's fit enough and he comes back, and whether he's able to, you know, maybe offset some of those issues with those other areas that he's really strong with.
Yeah, there was reports saying that Celtic played an in-house game against St. Mirren in the last couple of days, and Julian played 45 minutes of that, so that's definitely positive signs. Hopefully that means he's going to be ready to come in, and I'm really looking forward to seeing Julian beside Cameron Carter-Vickers to see if it works out as a partnership. A lot of people, and I mean a lot of people, have been asking us in the comments to talk about Antoine Ortega, the new Celtic data guy. Do you guys know much about him? Is that something you just want to talk about?
I don't want to.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of him or followed him on Twitter. I'd prefer not to get into individuals because, again, to me, it's not about individuals. I think it's encouraging that we're adding to the area in the club. I think, you know, more investment in the intellectual side of the club, I think, is good. You know, I think it can only be a positive, and we certainly hope that he's up for going into the Glasgow cauldron. Already seeing the response to him on Twitter, the poor guy having a Twitter account. We'll see how long that lasts. I wish him all the best and all the luck in the world, and hopefully he's up for the challenge. Yeah. Not only analytically, which I'm sure he is, but you know, more so the non-analytical part of what he's probably getting himself into.
So
let's talk about it more in the sense of Carr Starfelt, who we're putting down to as bad recruitment. So let's say this guy is, and I'm sure he is, qualified enough for this role. What are you looking for him to do differently when it comes to Carr Starfelt, assuming people are going to listen to what he actually puts forward?
So I mean, for me, you know, to echo what James said, this is more about if it's indicative of a culture whereby we're recruiting a deeper pool of analytical staff, then that's generally a good news. I can't comment on the individual, and I wouldn't anyway, even if I did know the guy. But what is, I don't think his role is going to be to necessarily tell Carl Starfelt how to defend. But if he can help to highlight some of the issues and go into some of the more deeper aspects that I talked about, which is looking at the minutiae of body shape, positioning, responses, anticipation, etc., and different triggers and how you respond to those. That if he's able to provide, you know, insight and context in that sort of level, I think that will be a step forward, because that is the level that a professional sports club should be looking. And there might be a couple of magic bullet things that sort of say, actually, Carl, you're always recovering off your left foot, and actually your right, you know, you should be powering off your right foot. You know, it's like, for example, you know, I was told today about James Forrest that his sprinting technique was poor, which was stressing part of the reason why his hamstrings were stressed. Little things, little physiological things like that, sports science insights, can actually make a huge difference to a player. So, you know, that's a combination of skills. That's analysis to say, we've got a problem anyway. Do you accept we've got a problem? That's the first thing. Second of all is, you know, physically, there's a physiological sports science area. Is the player actually moving properly? Are they conditioned correctly? Have they got the right, you know, body conditioning and technique from a physical perspective? And then thirdly, you've got to add in the actual football experts, the coaches of, you know, people who actually know how to defend properly, telling you how to defend properly. But, I, you know, no football club ever gets recruitment 100% correct. And, you know, Starfelt, I have to be very brutally honest here, Starfelt was, after Furuhashi, the second most expensive, you know, Postecoglou signing. and it's not been a good one. Okay, so we need to, you know, and I suspect, when, as James said, it's not going to get better. So we need to, you know, address that.
Yeah, I'll say, and so to segue from what Alan just said, is it's all about probabilities. I mean, that's what analytics and data are about, is how do you tilt decision making towards increasing your probabilities of success and doing better. So part of that is understanding value. So this is what we've talked about. For example, I've mentioned the new metric that StatsBomb has out, OBV, which is going more in that direction, right? So Alan talked about the importance with progressive passing, the idea of, okay, well, you can count progressive passes, but he does, was one of the, you know, one of the real value add with Alan's data collection, is he's put value on that, or a way of valuing that relative to something called an impact score, right? So there's ways that you could do, you know, if you have analytical skills, you could take counting stats and you might be able to kind of see patterns and put things together in a way of deduce things. So that takes a more advanced analytical skill set. As you increase the value and the accuracy of data collection through metrics, which is what we're moving forward now in the next generation with something called G plus and OBV, is that you're now going to quantify actual playing value. And that actually is what Moneyball was all about. It player trading, yes, but it was the inefficiencies and the understanding of what drove performance and quantifying that through measurement, and then being smart about how you're deploying resources, right? So not only is it an increase in intelligence relative to understanding value, it's then, okay, well, what does value mean relative to the manager's playing style and the context of the club that you're playing at? Meaning that, you know, as we talked about, you know, Celtic keepers really only have two shots that they face a game on average, versus somebody at another club that probably faces more than 2.5 or 3 times that in a game. So that is a different situation on a value perspective for that position. Center backs, can they pass versus are they going to bunker in inside the 18 and head the ball out with crosses? Those are very distinct roles. And how do you value what the performance is going to be relative to that? So it's getting intelligent about measurement, figuring it out. And then the last thing I'll say, which this is the next step, which is the real advanced clubs are doing research and development, which is they're not, you know, it's, I don't expect that to happen at Celtic anytime soon, but it's, you know, people get stuck in the hamster wheel, right? You got 2 games a week and you're doing opposition prep and you're getting ready for the next transfer window. It's putting resources and time into thinking openly. Okay, what are we doing here? How can we do things better? You know, what do we do as far as using metrics and doing research and analysis as far as figuring out, you know, maybe the manager's playing this certain way and thinks that this is a good thing to do, but let's test that. Like, let's actually go into this and test, like, are these smart decisions, and look at the global kind of pool of data that's available and see if people are doing things that actually add value based on conventional wisdom, or whether there's opportunities for people to say, hey, you know, and that's what gegenpressing was really all about, is people overvalued possession, you know, to a degree, which is you can think about making a risky pass in the final third. We've talked about that, Alan and I, is like, you know, taking risk with passes can be a good thing, particularly if you pair that with seeing a turnover as an opportunity to regain possession with a defense in transition that's more vulnerable, mm-hmm. right? How do you qualitatively or quantitatively measure those? And tailor your style of play to kind of optimize. I think what you'll see, hopefully, is that you'll get more resources towards building better profiles, better understanding of what players need to be good at. And certainly sees that with the 3 signings he's made from Japan. We've talked about that. These guys profile logically with what he's going to look for in those positions. And, you know, an analytical staff using data should be able to help make that an even better situation and optimize that, as opposed to just a guy knows people in leagues because he knows them. And that seems to be where we're at right now. I mean, even this guy McGree, who ended up going to Middlesbrough, it looks like that looks like somebody Ange knew and could do a job, right?
Or the agent was causing trouble, but let's
or the right.
So can I just, if you don't mind, can I just add a little bit of a different, another perspective to this? I don't know if you want to move on, Ender, that's fine. But I this is going to sound a little bit reactionary, actually. So I don't think we make the best use of the data that we already have. Never mind all these further advanced stats. And the reason I say that, and I'm not necessarily talking about clubs, because I'm not sure what clubs do, but there's a science to this, which is the collecting of the right information in the right way and building clean data and built to present it and benchmark it in a fair and an equitable manner. But then there's an art to this, and the art is the story that the data tells you. And this is generally the piece that people don't do well, okay? And it's because it's the hardest piece. It's the qualitative piece that goes over the top of the data. And I still think when I look, and especially because Twitter, we all use Twitter, right? But Twitter's really geared for getting little snippets of information out there, little bite-sized chunks. But actually, by doing that, you can certainly make points. You can make a lot of points. And some of them are very valid, but you miss an awful lot of nuance, right? And nuance takes a little bit of time with a lot more data points to tell a story and to build it. Nobody wants to read that on Twitter. And I still think, you know, from the analyst's perspective, and I'll give you two examples, really, real players to try and illustrate what I mean by that is, as you know, I was always banging on about the value, because that's where we came in about this. What is the value of these players? The value of Ryan Christie, right? And you could probably go across a whole range of metrics and say, well, yeah, but he doesn't have the most shots. He doesn't have the highest XG. He doesn't create the most chances. He doesn't do it. And he doesn't have win the most tackles. He doesn't. No, but he's probably third or second or fourth on every single one of those lists. And if you look at that whole package together and look at and the narrative of what actually is a Ryan Christie, it's actually a pretty awesome collection of attributes, none of which are exceptional, but all of them are useful. Right. The second one, and this is something I educated myself on this week when I wrote an article. It was about David Turnbull, because I was trying to sort of, I know that when you know that a player is valuable, you can't explain why. That was basically the problem that I set myself. And eventually I managed to find a view that showed that through sort of progressive passes, and I can't remember what the other thing was I used, you know, he doesn't top the rank on any of the creative dimensions and any of the creative metrics that we have. So like, well, Turnbull's the number 10. Well, he should be topping all of these, and he doesn't. But actually, if you put together a package of five or six metrics that all speak to a player's creativity, and if you were to find a way of aggregating them, he would probably be pretty much at the top of that pile. And that's the narrative. That's the story that you have to tell. Now, this guy coming back to dunk on data, if he's got the ability to persuade the coaches at Celtic or the manager even of the value of a player who's perhaps not playing, or to point out the fact that a player who is playing isn't perhaps performing and getting the value out of that we thought, like Starfield, then he's doing a fantastic job. And if he can do that, that to me would be a good analyst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's no point in collecting data if you're not going to use it. So that's why I sort of alluded to the fact
I know this myself.
They can bring in whoever they want. If they don't listen to him, it doesn't matter.
My spreadsheet's enormous, and 99% of it I don't share with anyone. Not because I don't want to. It just isn't enough time to actually look at it and you know, boil it down and come up with some insight from it. You know, so I think there's a lot more to go at with the data that we've got. Never mind, I'm all for pushing the dial forward in terms of new stuff. Obviously, I wouldn't say different.
Yeah. What's interesting to me, though, and it's funny how all of this has developed and become sort of mainstream, and people, like ordinary people, you see dropping in conversations about XG and data and different things into like mainstream media. And James, what you were saying about the gegenpress and everything like that there sparked in me the thought of Jack Charlton and Ireland at Italia 90, where he looked at the World Cups previously in Mexico and the US, and he saw that every single team used a number 10. Every single team relied on that number 10 to play the ball through. That's how they did it. Slow, keep possession, number 10 creates it, and two strikers up front. And his solution to that was put them under pressure, as it became known as. Even there was a song about it, which was getting the ball, even though Ireland had unbelievably creative players at that point, getting the ball, kicking it up into the corner rugby style and chasing after him, essentially doing gegenpressing before gegenpressing became a thing. I mean, that's what he said. He saw a weakness, he saw an opportunity, and that actually has had a detrimental effect on Irish football from that moment on. But at that point in time, it was extremely effective, and Ireland got to a World Cup quarterfinal playing it.
Yeah, so people have had analytical and pattern recognition skills for millennia. You know, Leonardo da Vinci didn't figure out all he figured out, even theoretically, hundreds of years before things actually happened scientifically, to catch up with some of his visions. And I mean that from an understanding physics even before, like, we had the equations in certain ways to prove it, right? So there's that intuition, that was the scale of you know, let's say managers, you know, a Jock Steen, the people who were able to kind of be visionaries and see ways of doing things ahead of time that others didn't. And they even may have had, relatively speaking, in a modern sense, rudimentary statistics that they were using. A lot of them did. If you look historically, a lot of these visionaries did quantify things in certain ways, looking for patterns. And so what the modern era in the last 10 years has really done is quantify more, measure more. And what that does is it squeezes out on the margins, and it dilutes the people that have that kind of natural ability, and it makes it even more difficult for those people to compete. You know, we've seen this throughout life, right? The human brain, certain ways versus computers, and now we've got machine learning and all these various things. They're not human brains. They're not as good as our brains are at certain aspects. But in other ways, they're much faster and better. And, you know, it gets harder and harder to compete against the machines, so to speak, in certain ways. And so not only did some of those things that were figured out by people qualitatively with a little bit of quantitatively historically, now that can be fine-tuned, optimized, you know, even more understanding, and situationally, conditionally, probability distributions built all around it, right? So it's all this geek stuff that can advance understanding and knowledge. But yeah, I mean, people for many, many years figure things out versus other. And this I always talk about, you get copycats, right? That's been going on in sports forever. Somebody's a visionary, figures it out, and then everyone doesn't even know why the hell it works. They just say, hey, let's go do that because that guy did it or that girl figured it out. Yeah. You know what I mean? So
I think football falls into there's nothing new in football tactics, right? And what Jack Charlton did, and credit to him for being a disruptor, okay? Because obviously, as you say, international football had fallen into a certain paradigm, a certain pattern of playing that became orthodoxy, and he challenged that orthodoxy. And that's great, you know, left brain, whatever it is, thinking. So and that's what you need to when you're a small country and you're trying to maximize the resources that you have. But there's nothing new about anything that he did. If you want to read about football tactics and the history of it, Jonathan Wilson, Inverting the Pyramid.
I'm listening to that right now.
Yeah, the best.
I'm listening
best
to that audio
book. Oh, read a book. Yes,
read the book. Yeah, best book on football tactics you'll ever. The only book on football tactics you probably ever need to read. But it essentially, if I had to summarize it in a paragraph, it's that essentially football tactics is a game of rock, scissors, paper, right? And it really is. And it's just a question of orthodoxies and shifting. You know, and disrupting. But in terms of what's really new, yes, you can make players run faster and for longer, so you've got advancements in that sort of physicality, but there's nothing new in terms of tactics and shit in basic shape.
Yeah, listen, I sat down and watched Man City play a 4-4-2 a couple of weeks ago, and I was laughing at how the commentators were talking about it.
Yeah,
Pep Guardiola's playing four players in midfield. What's he doing? This is brand
I enjoyed
new.
That while I was sipping my grapefruit IPA. I was enjoying the hipster
revolutionary
4-4-2. Yeah, well, that's good. You know, all this pressing, right? All this pressing. One of the ways to maybe beat pressing is have Niall Quinn up front with a little nippy lad and launch the ball at him. Brilliant! Just beat the press.
I for one welcome that. But right now I need to go and stick my audiobook on of that Jonathan Wilson book because I've got a 4-hour commute ahead of me. So that's where we will leave the show on tonight. We had a bit of a philosophical conversation there tonight. That's what you get on the Huddle Breakdown. If you want more of that, you can get us at Huddle Breakdown on Twitter, and you can follow us on, or you can subscribe to the YouTube channel below. Just hit the subscribe button. You get the Huddle Breakdown, the Monday Breakdown, and loads of different stuff as well. You can get us on Spotify, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts as well. So back again next week and actually have some football to talk about. So James, Alan, until then, thanks very much.
Safe travels, Enda. See you next week.
Safe travels. Take care, everyone.
All right. Cheers, lads. Chat to you later.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.